The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of the ways of understanding equanimity, what equanimity is by understanding what it's not. And in fact, one of the important principles of Buddhist practice is that it can be more important to focus on what gets in the way of Buddhist ideals than it is to dive into the ideal itself. So Buddhism has various ideals, like compassion is an ideal, equanimity is an ideal. And rather than just kind of making yourself compassionate, it may be more useful to study what keeps you from being compassionate or keeps you from being equanimous. And the reason why that's more useful is that who knows if you're really supposed to be compassionate? Or you're supposed, you know, in any particular situation, or you're supposed to be equanimous or whatever, whatever the ideal is. But if you can, if you let go of the obstacles to that possibility, those obstacles, a clearing of the field, in a sense, might allow for some other positive quality to arise that's maybe more appropriate. Maybe rather than being compassionate, what's required is to be generous. And so if you're no longer hostile to someone, then rather than being compassionate, you find yourself actually being more generous or kinder or some other quality. So, and also by studying what's the obstacle to the ideal, our relationship to the ideal can become much more realistic. It's very easy to be have a kind of positive, affirmative thinking, or that kind of covers over what's really going on, or a kind of denial of what's going on if something unhealthy is happening, and so my fixating on the ideal sometimes can create also kind of judgments and expectations and all kinds of problems. But if we honestly and realistically notice the obstacles, then our relationship to the ideal can also be healthier as well. So the obstacles to equanimity, the opposite of equanimity, could be called a reactive mind, a mind that compulsively reacts to what experience is, a mind which an activity, when the mind's activities behaves in a way that you don't feel you have much choice over, and it acts in a way that's painful. So if something happens and you resist it compulsively, reactively, then you're not equanimous. So, you know, for example, it might be an unsavory character walking down the street and who maybe is in need of help. And if you're reactive, you might just have your aversion to the person first and foremost. You might avert your eyes and not look. But if you can not be reactive, but stay calm and alert and attentive to what's going on, you might see that the unsavory person needs help. And maybe then you feel like you want to help. The fact that someone's unsavory, whatever that is, I don't know what that there are situations where people are unpleasant. I mean, it's not, you know, the fact that we feel unpleasant in their presence doesn't necessarily mean it's our fault. But there's something unpleasant about the person. But it's possible then with equanimity to just be present with an unpleasant situation. But if we're reactive, if we get pulled up in our agitation, caught up in our aversion, caught up in our judgments, caught up in our fears, then the mind would not be equanimous, not be balanced. When the mind is not equanimous, it's being pushed around. It's leaning towards something or pulling away from something as opposed to being balanced or even. It's caught up in its preferences. There's two people. One's a friend and one's not. And so you find yourself leaning towards your friend rather than being equanimous towards both, than being open and present for both in a kind of an equal way. So the reactive mind, the preferential mind, the compulsive mind, are all symptomatic of the mind that lacks equanimity. So what I thought we would do is do a short meditation, maybe about 10 minutes long. Knowing that it's short perhaps makes it easier for you to sustain this exercise. If you thought it was, And the exercise is just sit here with your eyes closed, doing nothing in particular. Some of you might have such a strong habit of meditating that maybe you'll, when your eyes close, and maybe you fall into that. That's okay if that has to happen. But just sit here with your eyes closed, nothing in particular, and then see if you can identify if and when your mind becomes reactive to something, or compulsive, or caught up in preferences, or being pulled into something where the mind gets contracted or tight or preoccupied, where the mind goes in a direction that wouldn't be your choice, but it's kind of an automatic pilot. Kind of, boom, there it goes, Or there's a loud sound, and the mind goes, oh, why do they have IMC in such a noisy place? And that's not equanimous, that's kind of a reactive mode. Or, anything at all. Or it could be sitting quietly, and you don't want to sit quietly. And so you start getting agitated. Well, agitation is, reactive. Or you're sitting here, and your knee hurts. And then you get afraid. And because of the fear is reasonable to have, but because of the fear, you get pulled into the world of fearful thinking and start fantasizing about, maybe you're going to need to have your leg amputated and, you're caught up in your reactions and preoccupations about it. So what I'd like you to do is for 10 minutes sit here and just notice if it happens. Maybe it won't happen at all, but then you can just count your blessings. And every time something happens in your mind that you think would qualify as a reaction or a compulsive tightening up or resistance or judgments or preference in some tight way or something, very calmly label it reaction. Just say reaction. There's a reaction. And so sit quietly, the eyes closed, nothing has to happen except you're being alert and attentive to notice if the mind does something that would be called reactive. And it's okay to be reactive in this exercise. Actually, maybe you're supposed to, so that you can just say, "Oh, there's a reaction," and then clearly see it. Oh, there's a reaction, and then the next time there's something, oh, there's a reaction, as opposed to an action. So the action would be to label a reactive mind, reaction. That make sense? Hopefully, it makes sense enough. So just close your eyes and nothing more to say. So, what was that like to label reactivity? Assuming, of course, that some of you had that.
It was useful to hear you describe contractions. Expansion or contractions. So I could, before anything gets full-blown into an aversion, there's a slight movement. And it was neat to tap into just these slight little movements. And by doing that, it sort of like cuts it at the quick in a way. So it's fun.
Great. Thank you.
Well, it was a very interesting experience for me because I'm pretty habituated to doing breath meditation, and I found myself doing bare awareness. And my compulsion was to bring my attention to my breath. And so I was sort of seeing the two sides of the coin of, you know, concentration on one side and vipassana on the other. It was a good thing to do.
Uh-huh. And then with the sense of were there judgments, preferences, leaning towards, aversions, resistances operating in that between those two choices?
It was pretty subtle. It's mainly a matter of training. I mean, mm-hmm. It's something I just do when I meditate, and this time as well, do something else, which is do nothing.
Okay, great.
Just pay attention.
Straight back there.
Oh. We've been interrupted. There's a black car blocking somebody's driveway.
A black car, right across the street? So across the street, there's a black car. Great. Those drivers are a little hard to notice. But,
thank you.
Yes.
So I'm newer to practice, and so I found myself getting very angry, like it was torture for me, having to not be able to go to a place that was that I could count on, the calming.
Uh-huh.
It felt out of control, and it felt very... I found myself getting really angry and being like, reaction. You know, mm-hmm. It felt torturous to me for 10 minutes to do that.
So... you feel, though, that it was useful in some way to see that tendency of yours? In what way might have been useful to have this revealed to you?
No, I think it was extremely useful. I don't doubt the usefulness.
In what way?
Just how severe it was?
No, just in any way.
The severity of my reaction.
So it was useful to see how severe it was. But
right.
What ways might this information that you used, revealed to you now, how might it be useful for you?
Well, it certainly gives me an appreciation for how nice it is to be able to go to another place that is much calmer and more uh-huh. peaceful and uh-huh. quieting.
Uh-huh.
That's.
And what about, did you learn something about a tendency that maybe you have in other situations as well?
Yeah, that's what originally brought me to the Dharma practice. I have a very, very active and
uh-huh.
reactive mind.
Uh-huh.
Hard to quiet my thinking.
So I wonder, listening to you, whether you know you didn't have your normal support, your normal kind of going towards something that's comforting.
Mm-hmm.
So you're left with yourself.
Right.
And then you had a reaction against that. Oh no, this is not good.
Right. So I have the right because I have the where you're taking everything away, like you've mentioned in some of the Dharma talks. Like, hopefully there's something left when you take away, you know, all the other things. And I'm at that point where I'm like, yeah, that sounds scary. I wonder if there is anything left when you take away everything else.
Okay, thank you.
I had a good experience, unlike the first one, which I had a very hard time staying with it, the first meditation. But I was amazed, actually, that I was able to have moments of where I felt not thinking anything, just kind of being. And then, of course, I'm more than half of the time I was in the reaction of something or other. But it wasn't, I never let it get really getting out of hand in a way that I got sucked into it. I found that extremely helpful. Just label it immediately. And when the feeling came up, just label it. Oh, there it is. And then go back to the peaceful state. So it's the first time I was really able to do that.
Beautiful.
Really nice to see. My mind is usually going 10,000 miles in every direction. But I had really some moments where I felt at peace and quiet.
Great. Thank you. So when I was sitting, when I first sat, you know, I closed my eyes to do it too, right? And the first thing that happened to me, I could see, was that my thought was, oh, did I explain this well enough to you? And that's a fine, that's innocent, that's a fine thought. I mean, it's reasonable, I should be concerned about that. But the reactive part was that I could feel welling up kind of from the center of my chest, a little bit of worry about that. So that was the reaction part. I wasn't equanimous, I was worried about, oh no. And so then that lasted for a little teeny bit, and then my mind kind of settled pretty quickly into a more concentrated, happy place. And that was fine. But then I saw my mind react to that and say, oh, this is preferable. This is better. This is where I want to be. This is good. You know, as opposed to just equanimity. This is opposed to like equanimity. Oh, this is what's happening. And I'm a little more settled. I feel good. I was preferring and kind of judging it. Oh, this is good. I'm glad for this. For or against things? Yes?
yeah, sort of in the same vein, because of the habit of practice, I would be planning, okay, now what? I was thinking about the board or whatever, and then I go, is that reacting? Is it just thinking, you know, planning? You know, can you plan? Can planning mind or something else arise without reaction? So if you're not reacting to it, you're just noticing it, then you just notice the next thing that arises.
Right.
Yeah? So yes. It's really what you were asking us to do is notice what we're reacting to. Where's the reactivity?
Right.
Reactive mind.
Right.
So you can have thoughts arising or planning mind or remembering as long as you're not reacting to it.
Right.
You're just being balanced. It's a balanced mind. Yeah.
The mind is a thought-making machine. It'll pump out thoughts. But the mind doesn't have to react to those thoughts. And so you can see, you know. So there's using this label, reaction, did any of you feel that you were more equanimous or less reactive as a result of just having a little label, noticing it as it was happening? And what was it like to be a little bit more, to be less reactive or more equanimous or more balanced? Or what was that like?
The labeling of it definitely stops my mind from following the thought, so it's helpful. But also the permission to be reactive was interesting because I wasn't very reactive. I don't know why, but...
We should give you permission more often.
Is it going?
Yeah. I'm not sure how to say this, but this is a practice I do a lot. I think it's, I realized sitting here today, this is the core of my practice. I didn't know that. And what I find is that when I'm able to be equanimous, my experience is so much more profound. So as opposed to leaving my experience, I actually gain my experience because I notice it instead of being it in the way that blinds me to it.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe, but...
What I'm learning and getting from this is, because I don't feel that I'm reacting big to things, but as I become more subtle with it, there's just the mind reacting to want to grab a thought, and I'm noticing just the subtleties even in my body, even when it's an okay thought and not a negative reaction to it, there's still like a grabbing just at thinking. That it's like, oh, I got to get this thought. It feels like it's getting deeper and deeper, and just noticing how thinking is just causing that to happen.
The glue that keeps us grabbing onto our thoughts. So, like, I had the thought, right? You know, did I explain this well enough? And then I kind of latched onto that enough to have a little bit of worry, as opposed to just, oh, that's an interesting thought. And let me take that into account, and maybe I should think about it and try better next time. or something, but you know. Great. So, so the theme is equanimity. And again, the idea is that equanimity is a good quality to have. It's a useful thing to have. It can be a powerful quality to have. It makes life a lot easier, makes it a lot safer, and it supports the cultivation of all the other beautiful qualities of meditation practice as well, or the other good qualities within us. Because if you're equanimous, there's space. If you're reactive, there's less space for other good qualities to come up. So it's good to kind of cultivate equanimity. Sometimes it's best not to cultivate it directly, but to create conditions for something to happen. So before I mentioned noticing what takes you away as being a supporting, but another thing is to notice what other conditions could be in place so that you can support equanimity arise. So for example, if you just want to be calmer in your life, you feel like, I need more calmness, then you don't go home and turn on every possible electronic device you can think of in the house. The radio and television and computer and iPod and iPad and, you know, electric toothbrush and I don't know, whatever you have. You know, have it all going. You know, that's not the right condition. You probably kind of leave things kind of quiet and off. And that would support your chance. You have a better chance of being calm, becoming calm then. So I'm going to offer you some conditions that support equanimity. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide you into groups. And then I'll go around to each group once you're divided into group and assign you one of these conditions to your group. And then you'll discuss in your group how this quality is supportive of equanimity. How it could be supportive of equanimity. And one person is going to be the, and then when we reform as a whole group, then someone from that group probably should volunteer at the beginning of your discussion, should be the person who reports back from your group. And it doesn't have to be, please don't try to make, say everybody said, we'll be here for too long. Your job is to maybe like in a minute or so, to somehow in your personal way, subjective way, convey the gist of what was talked about in your group. Okay, so you're not responsible for being an accurate reporter of what everyone said, because I don't want to spend a long time on verbatim lists. So somehow the gist, the basic ideas, or the most impressionable things that came out, and so it's a subjective impression. does that make sense? So. I guess we should do it this way. Why don't we count off 1 to 7, and you'll be in the group that your number is, okay? So remember your number. So.
1, 2.
So I imagine most of you don't know what the other groups were talking about. What their topic was. So perhaps whoever is going to report from your group, remember it's supposed to be brief, can first start by saying what the condition was that you were addressing. So the first group. So if you can wait for the mic, please. Just take the mic.
Our theme was virtue. How is virtue supporting equanimity? And so we first started out with, what is virtue? What is that really? And to come down to the where the rubber hits the road, we said, well, what are qualities which are considered desirable in this society of ours? And we came up with bravery, generosity, selflessness, honesty, fairness, and another quality is volunteerism, that people volunteer things. A lot of charities and so on help other people, and people contribute that much more. I grew up in Switzerland, and that's much less the case. People are generous, they give and so on, but going out and actually working with a charity or so is virtually unknown. Very few people do that. Anyway, and then we had the good fortune of having an Asian person in our group who comes from a different culture, and but she is a female, and she said for her, what was drilled into her was two things, and one is be obedient and gentle. So anyway, now how does that work by helping our equanimity? Well, obviously, one good example somebody brought up is that an honest person does not have to have a good memory. So in other words, by being a virtuous, you avoid a lot of problems for yourself and for others. You can harm yourself, you can harm others, you know, by lying, stealing, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. So I thought that was very good. And I was looking at it also from an energetic point of view. Like when you do something negative, when you react negative to a person or you attack somebody, you know, not physically, but otherwise, you're putting out negative energy. You're creating more negative energy in the world, and that has a ripple effect, just like good energy has a ripple effect. So that's the other side. So it's very important to realize how much effect we have as individuals in the society. And then we had to say that actually our environment here in our culture today is not really very conducive to virtue and equanimity particularly, because there is so much drive for success, for money, there is so much activity, so much busyness, bombardment with the media and everything. It's very hard to disassociate yourself so that you find quietness. So anyway, it's a task we all have to try to filter out as much as we can of that. Is there anything I missed that somebody would like to add from the group?
That's probably great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Wonderful. And it was wonderful to hear that. Then the next people should be a little bit briefer. So number two, group number two.
They left.
They left.
Very brief.
Group number two.
She's closer.
I will be brief. So ours was, how does faith support equanimity? And luckily we also have the other definition of confidence along with that. So faith, how does faith / confidence support equanimity? So faith can provide equanimity. Faith can allow you to continue and preserve when things are tough. You can continue. It was interesting. One thing that was said was equanimity allows you to be creative in life. And faith in equanimity will allow that dynamic to continue. So it's a sort of a self-referential feeding.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite nice. We talked a little bit about delusions that might come from certain aspects of faith. So luckily this practice is a very experiential-based practice that doesn't purely rely on faith to for its... Mm-hmm. For the practice.
Great. Great. So faith and equanimity, that's a great idea. Great. So group three.
Our question was, how does concentration and a strong mind support equanimity? So concentration and a strong mind. We also had some discussion that concentration was more focus and a lot more discussion about what a strong mind was. That sort of led our discussion. And we had some very good metaphors about it being like you're the captain of a ship, so you're not trying to control the ocean, and yet you can still, but that's what sort of the strong mind was, because that's what we had the most discussion about. And that it wasn't about controlling, but that the concentration gave you a sense of letting something be as it is. The concentration gave you the foundation to maybe choose equanimity. So there was kind of a steadiness. And so when you had the concentration, you were able to be steady, that then when you weren't in that concentrated state, you could still retrieve that level of equanimity in your daily life.
Great, thank you very much. So you can't control the ocean, but you can guide the boat. Thank you. So, group four.
So our question was, how do happiness and well-being contribute to equanimity? And if you would like a very brief response, it was, well, duh. But we still managed to find stuff to talk about. And trying to remember this, that that equanimity is possible without happiness and well-being, and that well-being is possible without happiness, but that both of them make equanimity much easier and much more accessible because there's an openness and a spaciousness that things just don't blow you off course in the same way when they're present. And also, as Victor was saying with faith, that equanimity and well-being really feed one another. There was also a sense that to have had an experience of happiness and well-being, even in times of, you know, darkness or depression, when those were inaccessible, to be able to remember that that existed was something that we could use to have more equanimity. And then finally, a sense that well-being and happiness really contributed to a sense of connection with other people. And, you know, sort of with all beings, that in some ways was a real guard against the things that masquerade as equanimity, the indifference or the complacency or the resignation or the superiority, and so that it was protected in that way.
Great, thank you very much.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm. So then the next group is five.
The introvert again here. So our discussion was wisdom or understanding, and Gil asked us, does this come out of experience? So there's quite a process. I'll just try to hit the key things. So the first, we start off with asking, isn't it a prerequisite to have wisdom in order to have equanimity? Talked about wisdom coming out of perspective, as being influenced out of learning and reflecting on things that have happened. There was a discussion about the serenity prayer, which is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So we talked about discerning the things that you can change, recognizing, talked about the five remembrances or any Buddhist teachings that talk about impermanence, And that evolved into discussions of acceptance. So recognizing, one of the things is not recognizing that not everything is about you. So when other people react, it's not necessarily about you. And then also the reactions come out of wanting to change things. So sort of back to the serenity, prayer, and acceptance. So the conclusion was that the most important thing, it seems, really is coming back to, through wisdom, what we realize is coming back to that not everything happening is necessarily significant, but what's most important is to return to the pure heart, or to return to the pure mind, or return to pure love, or what we might call returning to true self, which brought us full circle back to perhaps wisdom is a prerequisite for equanimity.
Beautiful. Thank you. So then six.
Our topic, or our quality, was clear seeing or insight as how it relates to equanimity. And another, not quite as brief or pungent as the previous one, but was the difference between, oh, whatever, and whatever. I mean, really embracing the difference of clearly seeing everything that might be going on and recognizing that it might be there and being able to hold that from a bigger perspective if you recognize all those that you might make one be able to handle whatever comes up, being able to hold it all there. Something else that Milo had mentioned was about the confidence of if you can clearly see the different facets that are going on, that confidence and being able to hold it and to make the right decision or be able to cope with whatever's going on, as opposed to pushing it away or just not noticing, not the awareness of not appreciating what is happening, and then perhaps not making the right decisions, not feeling the contraction. Everybody came back to the most important of recognizing the contracted state of recognizing that might be there, evaluating that so you could see what might be coming from that. And once that's recognized, then you can, kind of like the previous exercise of noting it, just noticing that it was there, but it doesn't mean you have to go with it, and that can lead to just a much more steady state.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then the final group, seven. Here in the front.
So our question was, how is freedom conducive to equanimity? The first thing that came up in our group was a snippet out of one of the Buddha's chants, which talks about freedom from ill will, freedom from anxiety, and so that's kind of interesting, just to the worth of the chants that can come up at the right time. So in general, of the hindrances, which can include judgment. It was also freedom from emotional triggers. And this came up over and over again to pay attention to the exact moment of when something starts to arise, because then that's when we have the opportunity to be free of it, because it doesn't have a grip on us yet. then free from the past or regrets and the future or worry. Free from compulsive thinking, free from the self, and then actually free to choose.
Great. So the seven conditions that support equanimity are virtue, faith, concentration, happiness, wisdom, insight, and freedom. So it's well worth considering these seven and how to support them and let them become stronger in your life so that you could be more balanced, more even, more equanimous. Equanimity is not something necessarily that exists in isolation from other qualities, other ways of being. And it's the mind is an ecology of these different species, and they work together. So for those of you who were not in, you know, when you heard the other lists, you might in your own time during the week or something reflect a little bit about the presence of these other qualities in your life as well, and what the relationship between them is and between and your ability to be non-reactive. So let's take our lunch break. We'll take an hour. Those of you who are new here to IMC, what happens at lunch